I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There. This is a podcast about the outdoors, from your window box and garden, to the fields on the edge of town, to the forests, prairies, seashores, and wilderness. On the show, we'll explore our relationship with nature through stories, interviews, essays, and even some fiction. We'll travel around the U.S. and the world with tales of love and heartbreak, passion and adversity, desperation and triumph. Today's episode was inspired by an exchange I had with a friend from Colorado. I was training for my first ever cross-country ski race. It was a half marathon, and so I was logging a lot of miles in preparation, which got me wondering how far I could ski in one winter. I posed the question on Facebook, is it unrealistic to try to ski 500 miles this season? My friend Joe was one of the first to respond. Easy, he said. I used to do that in a month. Now, you have to understand, Joe is a serious skier. He owns 20 pairs of cross-country skis, literally, and he was a pro racer in college. Speed matters here, he said. He explained that he averages 10 to 15 miles per hour. To put that in perspective, I usually go about half that speed. Then again, I didn't start skiing until I was in my 20s. I want to be able to do 10 to 15 miles per hour one day, I told Joe. Do you think it's possible to get to that level if you didn't grow up skiing? Absolutely, he said. Ever heard of Sarah Conrad? Of course I'd heard of Sarah Conrad. She's a local legend in Laramie, Wyoming, which is where I live. Sarah is an Olympic athlete. She's competed in both cross-country skiing and biathlon, which is a sport that combines skiing and rifle shooting. And what's fascinating is that unlike most Olympic-level athletes, she did not grow up doing these sports. In fact, she didn't start competing seriously until the age that many athletes are already retiring. So I decided to talk with her and find out what it takes to become really good at something at an older age.
It's funny when you listen to Olympians talk, because so many interviews of Olympians are like, I wanted to be an Olympian since I was three. Everyone says that, you know, since I was so little. And I don't ever remember when I first decided I wanted to go to the Olympics.
Sarah grew up downhill skiing, but it wasn't until college that she tried cross country. She immediately seemed to have a knack for it, but when she went to sign up for the ski development team at Dartmouth, she didn't make the cut.
They're like, nope, this is the first year, we're only gonna allow four people on the team. And I was like, no, but I wanted to learn how to ski. And they go, well, you're a senior, Sarah, you're kind of too old. And that was the start of my hearing, I'm too old, and that's been kind of a theme of my skiing for a long time.
Let's be clear, Sarah was 21 at this point, not exactly old by most standards. But for competitive skiing, she was apparently over the hill. Luckily for her, the team got a new coach, and she was allowed to join. During that final year of college, she raced often and did well. But skiing was still a hobby at that point, not something she planned to pursue professionally. It wasn't until several years later, when she started grad school at the University of Wyoming, that things changed. She turned 30 that year, which meant she was eligible to go to an event called World Masters, where she'd be racing against other older skiers.
World Masters was in Lake Placid in the U.S. that year. So I was like, perfect coincidence. It's easy to get to. I could go and race World Masters, just have a little fun. Had a lot of friends who were going. And I came away with two golds and two silvers from that. It was my first high-level competition, and I was like, huh, maybe I'm better at these shorter races than I thought I was. And so the year after that, I went to senior nationals, so with the young folks. And I think after I had success there is when at first kind of, I was like, well, I might be close enough to make the Olympic team.
And did you think you, at first, did you think you had a shot at the Olympics? I mean, you're up against people probably who have been ski racing ever since ever.
Right. You know, I didn't really worry about that. You know, you just see what the results are. So if you race well against someone, then sure, you got a shot. And people have been skiing forever. There's definitely exceptions to the rule, but there's a lot of people who just burn out. So say you've been ski racing since you're 5 years old and you're phenomenal. You race really well through high school. You race really well through college. And then you get into that really peak window of when a lot of Olympians are racing. and you're burnt. You know, you want to hang out with your friends. You want to go party. You want to do something other than ski race. And I kind of got all that out of my system in my 20s before I was ski racing. So in some ways, even though I was older, I think I was better prepared for the commitment to the sport. So that worked in my favor, I think.
So once you got this idea that, hey, maybe I'd like to try for the Olympics, how do you then make that happen? How do you go from somebody who did not grow up skiing to becoming somebody who can go to the Olympics?
Well, it was kind of a windy road. I mean, I just kind of said, well, I'll go to nationals. I got picked up by a ski sponsor. I was going to the Super Tour races. I shot for the 2002 Olympics, the ones in Salt Lake. And at that point, I was defending my PhD at the same time. So I was kind of had everything kind of all coming together at once. And, you know, I've never really spoken to sports psychologists much, but I did run into one at one of the competitions once. We were just having a conversation, and he pointed out something that was really interesting to me, because I always thought as I was going, I was like, well, yeah, I'm a geologist and yeah, I'm an athlete. And if ever one of the two wasn't going that well, I could always identify as the other. So if I wasn't racing that well, I was like, yeah, I'm a geologist. I'm just skiing for fun. Or if my geology whirls or something didn't go that well, I was like, oh, no, I'm an athlete. You know, I'm good. So it was kind of a crutch, really. And he said to me, he's like, you know, if you ever want to be really good, you're just going to have to pick one. You just have to go for it. And I didn't buy that right away, but then I also didn't make the 2002 team. I was one person off, just missed it. And that actually ended up pretty much being the same for world championships the year before, and then it ended up being the same for world championships the year after. And when they name teams, there's always some discretionary selection. So when I say I'm one off, okay, maybe it wasn't exactly one off because you're never quite sure how the discretionary thing goes. But I was in the position of being on the bubble. I was good, but I was one of those people they evaluated. They made the choice who went, and I was never that person. And a large part of that was because of my age, because all the coaches and the ski team said, well, you know, she's 34 at this point, and so we could take her, but what future does she have? And, I mean, I see the point there. It's valid because, you know, they look at your standard 34-year-old and people burn out pretty soon. They didn't look at me as someone who's still actually only 4 years into the sport. So I understand that philosophy, but it was really, really frustrating. And so I tried for 3 years being on the bubble, and I was never good enough to get off the bubble. And so I kind of got to the point where I was so frustrated, because I knew the reason they always chose against me was because of age. And I'd actually talked to a friend who was an attorney, and he said, well, you know, we could probably argue this in court. And I thought about that, and I said, well, if I win, what do I get? I get a spot on the team and teammates and coaches who hate me because I litigated to be there. And that was not appealing whatsoever.
Sarah realized she wasn't making enough headway as a skier, so she decided to change course. She wondered what would happen if, instead of focusing just on skiing, she added another activity. She knew there was this sport called biathlon, which is a combination of cross-country skiing and rifle shooting.
I'd never shot at all, any sort of rifle or anything, and I had a friend who was the executive director of the U.S. biathlon team. So I called him up, and this is now the year after, it was 2003, and I called him up and I said, Max, I'd like to learn how to shoot. Would you guys work with me? Would you help me out?
So you thought, well, maybe if I'm not quite making the cut just skiing, I should add in this other thing that I've never done before.
Yeah, it's a brilliant philosophy, isn't it? One of the things that worked against me, actually, in skiing was in when you're racing skiing and when you're gaining points and all the points that you need to gain the team, they take all your race results together. So you have to race skate races, you have to race classic races, and you have to race sprint races. And the only one that I was really world-class at was skate skiing. I'm good at classic skiing, I'm good at sprinting, but I'm not at that level, not even close.
And again, skate skiing and classic skiing, two different types of Nordic skiing.
Exactly. So biathlon is only skate skiing. So in some ways, I was like, well, I could shoot instead of doing classic. I don't know. Seemed like a fair trade. I thought it was something worth trying. I also being very naive, thought shooting would probably be easier than it is. But at any rate, it was a fun conversation when I called up Max and I asked him if they'd be interested in taking me on, and he said they would. And I said, but Max, he was actually an old college friend as well. And I said, you know how old I am, right? Are you sure you really want to do this? I'm 35 years old. And he said the most refreshing thing I'd heard after years of kind of age discrimination was, Sarah, we don't care if you're 95 years old, if you ski as fast as you do, we want you. So that was kind of the start. Biathlon team picked me up, and I started getting shooting training, and at the same time, I got skiing coaching, which I'd only had that 1 year on the development team at Dartmouth for a couple months. So I was really basically self-taught skier. I had a ton of bad habits. And the biathlon coach that I worked with, Olga Shalna, was really, really a good coach for me, really good technician. And suddenly my results for cross country got better because I had the coaching. And suddenly I wasn't on the bubble anymore. So kind of end of the story is I ended up making the teams for both cross country and biathlon 3 years in a row, which was awesome.
Had this advice, you have to either give up geology or give up skiing, and you have to make a choice, and you just have to do one.
I kind of gave up geology for a while. When the biathlon team picked me up, actually, they did it with a caveat. They said, you have to give up the other things that you're doing. One was your job as a postdoc, and two, I was also racing road bikes in the summers. I said, give that up, you need to train for biathlon in the summer. I said, okay, I'll do it. So I did.
Was that tough to give that up and just be focusing on biathlon?
Yeah, it was really tough. It was, I come from a family of pretty high academic expectations, and my dad is athletic, but my mom not at all. And I think the thought that I was giving up my career to do this was, well, my mom was very, very happy when I made the Olympic team, but she was never very happy about it until I did. So the whole road there was not really anything that she respected until she saw that end result.
She tried to talk you out of it?
I don't think she ever sat me down and said, don't do this. But she also said, so when are you going to get a job? When are you going to move your career on? But then my parents are divorced, and my dad was a lifelong athlete and a runner. And he really got into it. He was definitely my number one fan. And so he was always very encouraging that way.
So what did your training look like? What was a typical day or a typical week like?
When I was really in the thick of training, I was mostly in Vermont, where the biathlon team was based. And it was kind of interesting because biathlon as an organization, USA Biathlon, did not have a lot of money and funding support. So they worked in pretty close collaboration with the National Guard, who had a base in Jericho, Vermont, where there was a biathlon range and a paved roller ski loop. So we could stay there and we could train. It wasn't a very exciting existence. You're in the middle of the woods on this army base. There's really no one around, and you train pretty much most of the time. I mean, your whole day revolves around that. So get up in the morning, and the very first thing before breakfast, just go for a 15, 20-minute jog, and stretch to warm up, eat breakfast, and then we'd have the morning workout, which would be, 1-2 hours of shooting, skiing, shooting drills, that type of thing. And then you go eat lunch, you'd usually take a nap, and then you'd repeat the same thing, have an afternoon training session.
I can imagine that this may have gotten, I mean, obviously it's physically challenging, but I can imagine that it might have gotten emotionally challenging too, did it?
Well, yeah, very much so. In that, when I got into skiing and had success in skiing, it was always because I got a positive reinforcement on something. So I'd try a little podunk race somewhere, do well in it, and then you'd try the next level race. And so I'd kind of worked my way all the way up to nationals, and I was always doing well. I never had races where I came in dead last. I start biathlon and training with people who have been doing biathlon for many years, and I had the skiing, but I did not have the shooting at all. And every single time trial we did, every race, every drill, I was last, dead last. And it was really hard. I mean, it was really difficult to put myself, especially at age 35, in a situation where I was getting no positive reinforcement. And in fact, the message I was getting every day is like, wow, you're really bad at this. I mean, no one told me that, and my coach was great. He's like, yeah, you know, shooting takes time. You got to work on this, and you'll get there. You just have to put the time in. But just psychologically, it was really challenging.
It almost sounds like what I think a lot of college students go through initially. Like, they've been the straight A student in high school. They've been on the honor roll. They've been the best at everything, and then all of a sudden, they go to, you know, a really good college, and everyone else is also really good and maybe better at them, and it's sort of a reality check of like, how do I now deal with this? And
yeah, I see the parallel. I guess to this, it was just a little bit different in that even when you do that college thing, there's other people around you kind of going through the same thing, and there was no one else around me going through the same thing. It was me, and then it was the good people. And it was actually also kind of hard because biathlon is so small in the U.S. that everyone else on the team had known each other for 10 years, had been training together for 10 years. And, I mean, the reality is maybe there's a group of six or seven women who were at the top end on the national team, and four or five of those get chosen to go to Europe and compete every winter. So the number who went was a pretty large percentage of the group, and then all of a sudden I was there, and I was viewed as the outsider and the one who might be taking one of their spots away. So there wasn't a lot of camaraderie either from them initially, and that improved as we all got to know each other. But the first year I was struggling both with being the outsider and not really well received and learning a new sport. But I mean, I make it sound really tough, and it was tough, but it was also really cool.
So how did you get through these low points where you're, you know, kind of the outsider and don't feel like you're doing as good a job as everyone else? How did you navigate that?
I'm really, really goal-oriented, and I had the big goal, and I don't think I'd given myself a concrete time to do this in, but I guess I was probably thinking the 2006 Olympics and see how far I can go by then. So I was willing just to buckle down for, you know, that period of time.
So how long did it take you to get good at shooting?
I'm not there yet, actually. Shooting, you know, I ended up spending 4 years training for biathlon, both 1 year before I made the team and then the 3 years that I was on the team. And I was always, out of the people on the team, the worst shooter and the best skier. And so they balance each other out. And you have to be really good at biathlon, you have to be good at both. And I never got as good at shooting as I needed to be able to actually do really well on the world stage. I could do really well on the American stage, but not the world stage. I'm fine at shooting if I'm not moving and if I don't have a high heart rate and if I'm not breathing really hard. But that's the trick of biathlon, is being able to shoot in those circumstances. So it's both a physical and a mental thing. It's extraordinarily mental, in fact, because you can come in, each time you come in to shoot at a shooting stage in a race, there's five targets and you have five bullets, and the clock is running the whole time. So you have to be fast and you have to be accurate. And every time, it's always hit or miss. There's not, you know, a number of the shots. It's yes or no. And you come in and you'd be doing well in the race, and so you'd see the targets, you're like, if I just hit these targets, I am going to stay in the lead, and this is going to be awesome. And as soon as you think that, you'll miss them. And so, because you want it too much, and it's so difficult thing about shooting is as soon as you want it and as soon as you care, you miss. Whereas with skiing, if you want it, you just ski faster, you ski harder, and that's what I was totally used to. I mean, it's the perfect kind of type A personality type of thing. You're like, this is what you need to do, so you do it. It's easy. Whereas shooting, it's kind of, you have to be almost type B, and you have to not want it. It's very zen. And if you watch biathlon races and you watch people shoot, the most common target to miss is the last target, because they're like, I've gotten the first one, I've got the second. If I get this last one, I've won the race, bam. Miss it every single time. So The physical skills are hard to learn, but the mental aspect, I never got down, and I needed more time to do that.
You say you never got it down, but you did go to the Olympics.
We could always be better, right? But no, I mean, if you looked at my stats compared to like everyone else at the Olympics and the games I competed in, or at the World Cups when I was racing those, I would be ski times in the top 10 or 20. If you looked at my shooting, I was in the bottom 10%.
So why did you want to be a pro racer? Was it because you liked racing, or was it because you wanted to prove you could, especially since you'd been told in the past you're too old for this already?
No, it wasn't about proving it. That was fun. I mean, it was really fun to be able to make the cross-country team after being told I was too old for it. But I just really liked doing it. And my I think the bottom line for me and what I really enjoyed the most was just seeing how far I could go.
Being part of a team where presumably many of your teammates were younger than you and maybe didn't even have any kind of other established careers yet. Like, this was the only thing they knew. This was the only thing they had done. Did you feel like you fit in there?
That's a good question. And you pretty much identified what it was like. Really, on my team, and biathlon, the people that I traveled with and raced with, most people were 10 to 20 years younger than me. Most hadn't even completed an undergraduate, much less a graduate degree. And evening conversation was about training, about food, about girls, about boys, but it was never about what books anyone was reading. It was never about things that I was kind of used to doing and talking about, or wasn't about, wow, those mountains that we're in. I mean, look at those glaciers and, you know, the geomorphology, and that's all pretty cool. And no one ever wanted to talk about any of that. But so that definitely got old, for sure. I really missed kind of more intellectual conversation, and I'd always have a very good stack of books with me on the road. And they're really nice people. I mean, everyone was great, and I'm still in touch with everyone and friends with everyone. It's just I like having that mix.
Do you think this is something that anyone can do, to take a sport that you didn't grow up doing and become really, really good at it, like elite level good at it?
No. I mean, that sounds, I don't mean to sound cocky or anything there, but I mean, I had a talent for it, and I just didn't discover it until really late. And it's just like anything. We all know there's areas that have more aptitude for than others. So no, I don't think anyone can start a sport late and actually become elite level. I think anyone can start a sport late and have a whole lot of fun doing it and really enjoy it and really have it become a passion for them.
Because, I mean, I'm just picturing people listening to this and saying, well, I like, you know, skiing or biking or running or whatever it is I do. I want to go to the Olympics. Like, can I do that?
And some of them can. You know, really, it's trying to get to a super elite level in something it's a lot of luck, I think, in some ways. So you can't always, you know, especially when you're not even close to that to start with, you just don't have any idea how possible it is. So why not try? Oh, might as well. But I mean, there's sacrifices along the way, too, that a lot of people aren't willing to make. I mean, how many people are willing in their mid-30s to turn off everything else, living out a suitcase in Europe, going from hotel to hotel with a bunch of 20-year-olds? Not that many people, really. It's not, I mean, at that, a lot of people, my friends, at least at that point, were getting married, having kids, and it's, you know, you couldn't have done that. But, yeah, I think, I don't want to say, yeah, you're listening to me talk. Yeah, sure, go ahead. Try for the Olympics. Might as well. I mean, if that's something, if you really, really, really want something, I mean, that's honestly 2/3 of the battle, honestly. so much is said about natural aptitude for something and body type and all of that, but the mental aspect is so huge in any of those things, and it's being able to persevere through the obstacles. And I think all of that is just a function of desire. So the more you want something, the more likely it is to happen, I think.
Did skiing continue to be fun this whole time, or did it become work? Obviously it was work, but did it become did it become unfun at some point? Did you like overdose on it?
I never overdosed on it. I love skiing. I really, really like skiing. And it's funny because even after I retired from international competition, I kept racing regionally until last year. Last year was the first year I haven't raced in 20 years. And now I'm still training, and I even run interval sessions and do intervals once a week. So I'm not racing, but I do intervals, and you're supposed to do intervals so you can race better. But I just love skiing. It's really fun.
How was the transition when you retired from professional racing? How was the transition back to science, back to your other career, your real life, as your mother might have put it?
Right. Well, at least on the one level, it was really easy in that I just walked into the office of my last postdoc advisor after a five-year hiatus and said, "So, Scott, what do you have for me?" He's like, "Oh, well, I've got two different projects. You could choose either of these, and can you start tomorrow?" So it was a little bit hard at first not going to the big races that my friends, you know, and teammates were still going to. And I was like, well, did I make the right decision to retire right now? Could I be doing these? You know, what would I be doing if I were there? So I missed that a little bit. Part of, I think, what made that transition easier for me in some ways was I, at that point, then got very involved as an athlete rep to the USOC's Athletes Advisory Council. It's kind of like a senate for athletes because you have two athletes from every sport, male and female, and we do business on behalf of athletes and athlete rights, all coming together, sharing best practices, sharing what's going on, helping each other out. And we were able to make some pretty good strides. And because before any of this was in place, athletes could really get taken advantage of. And there could also be some pretty unfair treatment of athletes, such as, well, I think you're faster, so I'm going to take you, or you've done an extra favor for me, so you get to go to that competition. And there wasn't really much regulating kind of selection procedures or who got paid or, you know, that type of thing. So we really advocate for all those things. We do things like working for healthcare for athletes, working on a career program for retiring athletes. Working right now, a very big project is helping get the USOC an independent safe sport center to deal with allegations in sport of sexual misconduct and that type of thing, which is, you know, we're so far behind the university system in that, you know, in the university system, if a professor has a sexual relationship with a student, there's going to be very severe consequences. But that's not true in the sporting world. A coach can have a relationship with the student, and it's that same power dynamic from the coach to an athlete as it is from the professor to the student. And it was looked at for a long time in the athlete world, oh, that's just how it works. That's who you're hanging out with. But it's been abused a fair bit. And so now, finally, the athletic world is catching up to that. And we're part of that as well. So it's been really a fun group to be a part of.
So are you pushing for more acceptance of older athletes?
You know, not directly, not at all, actually. Really what we're doing is advocating for good selection criteria that are very clear and are not based on any sort of discriminatory factor. Whether it's age, whether it's gender, whether it's sexual orientation, that type of thing. But it's, you know, I'd love to be able to see more of me out there. But and I think that's gradually happening. I think, you know, as our society changes and people stay active longer and put off having families until later, I mean, there are more and more healthy, very, very fit, you know, people in the master's category.
Looking back, is there anything you would have done differently? Would you have done all of this again?
Oh gosh, I mean, there's probably always small things that do differently, but none of them sticking out to say, oh yeah, I'd go back 15 years ago and drink my coffee and out of my left hand.
No, but I mean, was it worth it? Was it worth all of the time and the effort and the, in some cases, sort of emotional isolation? Was all of that worth it?
Yeah, everything was absolutely worth it. Yeah, I'd do it all again in a heartbeat. I mean, it's just being an Olympian. I mean, that you never lose that, right? You always have that label. And I mean, a lot of people, I don't really broadcast it that much. In Laramie, people know me and know of me if they don't know me, so they know that story, but I don't bring it up when I meet new people, and sometimes they might go for knowing me weeks and months before they find it out. And when they do, even though they know me as a person, you're an Olympian? Oh my gosh, that is so cool. And it's fun seeing people do that. It's really fun. I mean, that gives you a certain I don't know, cachet. It's like people are just like, that is so cool. And it is really cool. And it's fun to have that, you know. It even helps in looking for jobs, because you can say, yeah, I mean, I'm an Olympian. And so to be an Olympian, I had to work this hard. I had to show I had great determination. I have great perseverance. So I'm going to be a great employee because I'll bring all that to your company or something like that. I mean, it's a tool that stays with you, and it just keeps, it's kind of a gift that keeps giving, really.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're absolutely welcome.
Again, that was Olympic cross-country skier and biathlete Sarah Conrad. She lives in Laramie, Wyoming, where she co-directs a science education program housed within the University of Wyoming and funded by the National Science Foundation. As she mentioned, she also chairs the Athletes Advisory Council of the U.S. Olympic Committee. That's it for this episode of Out There. We'll have a new show the second Thursday of every month. If you haven't done so yet, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. And if you like what you heard, be sure to leave us a review. We're hoping for 5 stars. Our website is outthereshow.com. If you have an idea for a story or interview, or you'd like to submit something you wrote, you can do so there. You can also follow me on Twitter at Willow Belden. Our theme music was written by Jared Arnold. If you'd like it, you can hire him to write music for you, too. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.